Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Well, we had an election yesterday, and this morning, today, we have a lot to process. America and Texas moved further to the right by a lot. To help us take stock in this new political reality, I'm joined by Gilbert Garcia, former Express News Metro columnist. Gilbert, welcome back to Source.
Thank you.
And also with us is Sanford Nolan. He is the editor-in-chief of the San Antonio Current. And Sanford, welcome back.
Great to be here.
And we invite your phone calls. What did you see happening? Why do you think we got these results? If this was not the outcome that you were expecting, well, then how will you move on and deal? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can also send us an email to the source at tpr.org. Sanford, let's, I guess, start off by talking hyper-local in San Antonio. We had all of these charter changes on the propositions, and they seem to have swept through, and City Hall got what they wanted.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, right, because they didn't do a whole lot of promotion. They didn't do a lot of voter education. There were polls early on that showed that people didn't were not even aware that this stuff was going to be on the ballot. I certainly talked to, friends and associates who said they were surprised when they saw them on the ballot, folks who don't necessarily pay a lot of close attention to politics. But at the end of the day, all six of them passed, including Prop C, which is the one that the firefighters union came out against, the one that would limit the pay and salary of city managers, or does limit the pay and salary of city managers. I think that's an interesting one, because the firefighters, right, fought for that in 2018 when they were in the middle of a bare-knuckle brawl trying to get a new labor contract.
And new city manager.
Yeah. What's that?
And a new city manager,
which, after it passed, she was out the door, I think this time around, it's interesting that they didn't really get a whole lot of traction. I mean, I saw them at the polling places. I saw them talking to voters about why they continued to, why they're against Prop C. But I think part of the problem here is last time they had a boogeyman. They had Cheryl Sculley, and a lot of people knew who Cheryl Sculley was. They'd heard her on the radio. She, talking tough with the police union, talking tough with the firefighters. This time around, they didn't really make Eric Walsh, the current city manager, the boogeyman. I think he was a little harder to demonize, and I'm not quite sure they want to, because they're going to be negotiating with him again in 2 years for a new contract.
Well, Gilbert Garcia, there's also the proposition that passed that changes the term of office for city council members from 2 years to 4 years.
Right.
That is going to dramatically change how City Hall operates.
Yeah, and I think that one was probably the hardest one to justify in talking to people. I knew people who thought, well, what is really the purpose here? I mean, you can argue that it takes some of the politics out of being a council member. You get more time to concentrate on your job, and you have to worry about politics less. But I think a lot of people like being able to vote every 2 years for a council member. Nonetheless, this passed. One thing that was also really interesting among these propositions was the fact that you had council pay and mayoral pay increased without a lot of heavy opposition. When this happened, it was nearly 10 years ago that the city finally decided to actually start paying council members beyond the $20 per meeting. And there was tremendous opposition at the time. They did it during a May election cycle, which is, I think the calculation was here. If you do it in November, you have a bigger turnout. You have a better chance of getting it passed. And they were able to do that without too much trouble.
That assumption that if you do it during May, it's harder. But then again, not enough people pay attention. It might be easier to sneak things through.
Yeah.
But in November, we have everything else happening around us all the time. You might have more people at the polls, but no one knows what's going on.
And if they're not sure, they're probably going to vote yes. I mean, because I just think it's natural that if people are not sure what's going on with the any proposition, they're going to be a little more likely to vote yes.
Yeah, I think if the mood of the city about governance is generally kind of positive, which I think we could say right now, people are mad about street construction and some other things.
Yeah.
But I'd say, you know, generally the mood is not too bad. And I think that was the reason you didn't necessarily see a giant campaign for these things until the last minute, was because the assumption built in was that, yeah, if we kind of just put these on the bottom of the ballot, mm-hmm. most people are going to go ahead and say, okay.
Right. Well, they were thinking that their people were going to vote no, just straight up. They thought that was the result. They didn't think people had that positive of a rapport with City Hall. And it was 2-1, pretty much, that these things passed. I'm going to go to a caller. Our number is 833-877-8255. And we're asking you, what do you make of the results from the election, local, state, national? And let's go to Tony. Hey, Tony, you're on the air.
Hey there. Thanks for having me. I'll try to make this short. But ultimately, there's very little that's going to change with Trump. I mean, he's been in power before. The things that are going to change is the rich are going to get richer, and the working class is kind of going to have to deal with, you know, paying more for things like education, for cars, for homes, you know, whereas they have to take out loans. So you're paying a lot more for all those items. And you know, nothing's going to change because the system prevents change. If you go back to the Federalist Papers and James Madison, he spoke about factions and how they were dangerous. So the system has checks and balances. The system has separation of powers. You can promise the world, but it's never going to be a reality. So there's very little that's going to change. In 4 years, we'll have a new president.
All right, Tony, that seems like an optimistic point of view. And Gilbert Garcia, do you share that view?
I do think that, for example, if Trump follows through with his plan for mass deportation of undocumented immigrants, they're going to be he's going to have some serious legal challenges, and not to mention the fact that I think when he's in office, the practical challenges, and that's a mild word, of enlisting the military, as he's described, to be knocking door to door, and you've got families where you have family members who are citizens, you're going to have family separation involved. Not that that's ever bothered him in the past, but I think that the challenges of actually doing some of these things will kick in for him. And I think that he's talked about huge tariffs across the board. He has people in the business community who are supporters of him, who are probably talking to him, will be talking to him very soon and telling him this could be disastrous for the economy.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, echoing that on the business community, a lot of people tend to think of, you know, folks who are here on a green card and bring their families over. You know, they're ditch diggers, they're agricultural workers. You know, this has the implication to affect doctors, lawyers, IT professionals, people who come over here specifically invited by businesses because of their expertise. So, and I think there are a lot of businesses that rely on seasonal labor, that rely on, you know, immigrant labor, the meatpacking industry, that this is going to have a big effect on as well. And it will be interesting to see whether he listens to the business interests that are certainly going to come at him.
And if you think about it, the economic argument was one of the strongest arguments he made against immigration, which is saying you're taking black jobs, you're taking Hispanic jobs. But I think I don't know, trust that he's going to have people in his administration, but I think there will be people on the outside who will be telling him this, the effect of this will be disastrous economically.
Right, we're going to take a break. We'll continue discussing the results of the election, looking at it from the local point of view, from the statewide point of view. We can talk about these House seats and also nationally and internationally. We're going to be talking about the strategic implications for foreign policy when we come back from the break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're deconstructing the results from our election, our history-making election. You can say all elections are history-making, but I'm pretty sure this one is even bigger history-making than most. President-elect Donald Trump is planning to put into action his campaign promises, and that does mean a global shakeup. And we're joined by Matt Gertkin. He is the chief U.S. political strategist for BCA Research. He did forecast a victory for Trump and the Republican majority for the Senate. And Matt, welcome to The Source.
Welcome to The Source. Welcome to The Source. Welcome to The Source.
And Matt, are you there?
Yeah. Hi. How's it going, Dave? How's it going, Dave?
Oh, we got some mean feedback there. Were you able to clear that up on the board? Hang on 1 second. Okay, Matt, are you there?
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 Okay. Are we having a problem with our audio connection on that with the Zoom link? And I tell you what we're going to do, if we can hang up on the Zoom and try to call him on the phone. All right. Matt, are you there? Okay, no, we're going to do that. All right, so I do want to say what Matt is going to be talking about is the global implications with a Trump victory. He's not just the president of the United States, but he's also the leader of the dominant superpower in the world who has and under Biden. We've seen implications for, you know, what's happening with Israel and Gaza, also with Ukraine, their war against the invader of Russia, trying to stymie that invasion. Also, the immigration part of all of this, we've seen that Trump is trying to talk about, you know, limiting and sealing the border for immigration. And Matt, do we have you now?
Yeah, we've got me on here now. Thanks,
okay.
Dave.
Sorry about that technical glitch. So can you give me the overall view about when with Donald Trump, if he puts into place what he has talked about, his campaign promises for international relations?
Yeah, well, I think we should start by recognizing that Trump is going to be entering office when the U.S. has two proxy wars going on in Eastern Europe and the Middle East, and a trade war ongoing with China, which, of course, never ended, and Trump has promised to escalate it. So that's a lot on the foreign policy agenda. And, of course, there can always be new contingencies that emerge. So he's got a full slate to deal with. Now, he is credible on the idea that he can reduce support for Ukraine and try to push for a ceasefire and draw down that conflict. And I think Russia might actually go for that. So he could de-escalate relatively quickly in that conflict. But the Middle East is going to escalate. So we're just going to be sort of out of the frying pan into the fire when it comes to foreign policy.
So what happens in Ukraine if Russia stands down and they go along with this peace plan while Russia regroups? That's not really going to impact domestic markets very much. But if we see an expansion of an Israel-Iranian war, would that have an impact, say, on like global oil supplies?
Yeah, I think it will, actually. So one of the interesting, you know, geopolitics is always sort of counterintuitive. And we've seen since October of 2023 that this war has been spreading across the Middle East, even to the point that it's now direct between Israel and Iran. And yet it hasn't caused any major oil shocks. And that was a surprise for the markets. But now we're entering in a phase where it really will escalate, because one of the parts that was, I think, maybe not fully understood is that the Biden administration was restraining Israel, even though Israel has been very aggressive over the past while, and especially the past 2 months in going after Hezbollah and Iran. They were experiencing, you know, the Biden administration saying, well, don't go and cause an oil shock right before an election. We can't accept that. And Lloyd Austin, the defense secretary, even asked Israel, you know, are you prepared to defend yourself, which is a huge threat. And so there has been a restraint, and now that's gone because the election's over. So Israel will not be able to be restrained by Biden in the lame duck months of his presidency, and Iran will not be restrained anymore either, because they will anticipate that Trump will come in and impose sanctions and you know, actually enforce the sanctions on their oil exports. So this is about to heat up in a major way, and I do think it will start to cause oil supply shocks. And so it depends on how the economy is doing. But those oil supply shocks will matter if the overall global economy is growing.
The 10-pole policy that Donald Trump ran on was cracking down on undocumented or non-citizens, people in the country. His spokesperson was announcing that they were planning to move forward on day one with a plan for mass deportation, including people who have qualified under DACA to be removed from the nation. What do you think this would do to U.S. labor supplies?
Well, let's see. So we've had anywhere from 8 million to 11 million new illegal immigrants over the course of the past 4 years. And so the impact immediately in the labor market may not be felt. You know, you actually have right now some softening and some new slack emerging in the labor market just because demand is slowing down from where it stood in the immediate post-COVID context. But over a four-year period, if you comprehensively reform immigration, which I think Republicans will definitely do if they have full control of Congress, and I think they will. So they will be able to restrain immigration significantly, and they'll maybe be able to do some deportation. And so those combined effects will tighten the labor market. And it's just been a factor that U.S. corporations have really relied on for quite a while in order to keep their profit margins down, and they won't have that anymore. And so that's a political win for the president and his and you know the 51% of the country that voted for him. But economically, it could suppress potential growth a little bit. About 60% of U.S. labor force growth is coming from foreign-born workers, so you're going to be suppressing that a little bit, and that'll have a negative side effect. And of course, it's a political question whether someone believes that that's a good thing to do or not.
Well, you know, Trump has the support of business behind him. Will business tell him to back off on this? Would they be successful? Or was this too big of a promise that he made to the voters, especially in the swing states?
Well, that's a great question. You know, and it's a question of strategy. If you look at the exit polling, only 39% of people supported deportations. So, and immigration alone was the fourth biggest issue in the election, and only 11% of people said it was the biggest issue. So there's not really screaming demand for President Trump to deport people. In this election, he didn't win this election because of immigration. He obviously, his base was very motivated on that issue, so that was important. But the biggest factor was inflation and the economy. So, you know, so basically, he's not forced to do this. And from a strategic point of view, you could see his political advisor saying, well, look, you know, deportations are going to look really bad. They're going to be all over the TV screens because it's going to be messy, and it's going to hurt people, and it's going to break up families and cause a lot of bad press. So you could see an attempt to do that maybe to some extent in a way to partially fulfill the promise, but maybe not go overboard, maybe focus very surgically on criminals, which would, of course, be the best form of that policy.
Which was Biden's policy.
Yeah, although he also opened the gates from the beginning and let in 8 or 11 million people, whoever's numbers you're using. So, you know, he wasn't able to articulate that. But I think you're right that would be a clear bipartisan policy to deport criminals. And so if they stick with that, then that could be a win for them. But if they go for large-scale deportations like they've talked about, then it could be a huge distraction, and it could drain a lot of their political capital, because the evidence is clearly that that's not really what voters were asking for. They want the border to be secure. They want illegal immigration to be better processed and better controlled. But no one was really asking for deportation, so that could be a policy mistake.
Right. Let me sneak in one last question here. You know, as Trump is promising massive tariffs with China, that's an inflationary pressure. Oil prices could spike if we see an escalation, expansion of the Israel-Iran war, and then the contraction in the labor market as we lose so many people in our labor supply. Those are all inflationary pressures. So how will he make good on that promise?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that is the key takeaway here is that this is it's like an habanero-infused cocktail of inflation. And you've got the large deficits, you're curbing the labor supply, and then it so happens that you're also going to be dealing with this critical juncture in the Middle East, which I think is likely to cause oil shocks. So put it all together, probably we will see inflation revive. Now, the Fed is going to continue to be vigilant, and that will be even more relevant in a post-election phase, because the Fed can do most of its hiking in the non-election years.
Right, but Donald Trump says he wants control of interest rates.
Well, there you go. So I was going to get to that because, you know, even if the Fed wanted to keep rates higher for longer or even, heaven forbid, if they had to hike rates again, well, the question is, the president actually does have the power. It would be legally disputed, but he does have the power to remove the Fed chair and then deal with the legal disputes afterwards. And then he's got to get through the Senate in order to confirm someone. But since the Republicans have won a sizable majority in the Senate, they actually could potentially confirm someone who's a little bit more partisan of a Fed chair, because there's just enough margin there that maybe the moderate Republicans won't be able to prevent that from happening. And so you could end up with a Fed chair who's a little bit softer, and that would then feed into that broader inflationary narrative. So my guess is that the first things we'll see is that the world will be concerned about a global trade shock, and you've got to pass some of these bills, and so the inflation isn't going to just pop up out of nowhere. But once you get this legislation passed, and then you have that critical Senate vote on confirming a Fed chair, that's going to be an environment in which you really could start to see inflation expectations rise and a lack of price stability become a problem once again.
Matt Gertkin, thank you so much. I kept you longer than I promised you, and I appreciate your extra time. Thanks so much for talking to us and helping us break this down. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Dave. Real pleasure.
Matt Gertkin is the chief U.S. political strategist for BCA Research. And Gilbert, what did you make of that?
Well, one of the things I was thinking about when Matt was talking about maybe some kind of smaller scale deportation that could give Trump the perception of a victory on an issue that he talked about without him having to deal with all the fallout of the reality of it. I was thinking about his rhetoric in 2016 when he ran for president saying that NAFTA, the trade agreement with the U.S. and Mexico and Canada, was the worst agreement ever. It was a horrible deal. He essentially ended up, and we're going to just totally like, scrap it. They basically tweaked it.
Well, what they did is they said, okay, NAFTA's terrible. Let's get rid of it. They tanked it, and then they replaced it with NAFTA.
They replaced it with NAFTA.
That's probably what they'll do with the Affordable Care Act.
I could see that happening. I think with something like the immigration, the deportation issue, it's possible that what he wanted with NAFTA was just to tweak it, give it a new name, and claim a victory. And if he can find a way, as you said, deporting criminal immigrants would be a continuation of existing policy. But we know that he could frame it and would be likely to frame it as something
right.
new.
Right, and so, Sanford, all you have to do is just say the border is secure. And if you don't have, you know, Fox News or whatever repeating that over and over again, then therefore the border is secure. I wonder if we need to continue with Operation Lone Star, multi-billion dollar program in Texas, if we're going to have Trump in the White House claiming that the border is secure.
Yeah, that will be interesting to see how much more the Texas ledge is willing to give Abbott to continue throwing billions at that.
Because this next legislative session is going to be a lot tighter than the last one.
Oh, for sure. Money. Yeah. Now, the other thing I think is interesting, I don't want to call it buyer's remorse, right? Because people should know what they got when they purchased a second Trump term. But I do think there is going to be a certain number of people who are going to realize, oh, this affects me. The Affordable Care Act that I was relying on for
Social
my health
Security.
Insurance is about to go away.
Medicare.
Yeah,
Medicaid.
You know. Yeah, I mean, all of this stuff.
But there's no backseas,
my
man.
Family,
there's no backseas.
Half of which have government jobs.
This is Pottery Barn,
what about
dude.
The CHIPS Act?
Huh?
What about the CHIPS Act? I mean,
yeah.
Mike Johnson kind of going back and forth on that.
Right, but this is Pottery Barn. You break it, you bought it.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
There is no going back.
No, I do think it will be interesting to see how fast some of this really hits people in the pocketbook and how drastic the pushback is in the midterms and then again at the end of that 4-year term, because I think there are going to be a lot of people who thought, oh, I'm voting for him because of the economy and because of inflation. They're going to find out that stuff is going to get worse.
But then they can diffuse the rationale why things have gotten worse, and people don't have to actually understand that this is part of.
Well, I think Trump loyalists will do that, but I think there are a number of people who
somehow it's Nancy Pelosi's fault. I don't care where she, you know. All right, we got to take a break here. Our phone lines are open. We want to hear about how you plan on moving forward with the world of Trump. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davison. We're talking about the election and living in this world where we now see that America is further to the right than many people had expected. And it is probably a much harsher, tougher world than many of us had hoped for. But this is what we got, and this is what we got to deal with. So moving forward, how are you going to live in Trump world? Give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And let's go to a caller. We have Pauline. Pauline, you're on the air.
Hi. Hello, Davey. I was a finalist to be Councilman Perry's interim replacement. I want to thank Mr. Garcia for his kind words and coverage when we went through that. Now working in District 10 as a staunch progressive, I'm doing economic development work for Councilman White. And I just want to say that he and I talk. We talk. We communicate. We find common ground. And we try, at least on my part, to keep the emotions as best out of it and focus on the nonpartisan issues here in the city. I would just hope that the Trump administration would have perhaps liaisons or someone who could assist in the communication efforts with the Democrats and the progressives.
All right. Well, that's a big hope because right now, Gilbert Garcia, do the Democrats have any sway in Washington, D.C., moving forward?
We still don't know what the final numbers are going to be in the U.S. House. California, they're counting mail ballots probably as we speak. But it doesn't look like Democrats will. If you think about, you know, Donald Trump came to office proclaiming himself the deal maker, his ghostwritten book, The Art of the Deal, is kind of...
A lot of people have ghostwritten books.
But the point is, he used that book to kind of define who he is, and he actually was highly unsuccessful at when it came to. He got Paul Ryan, then the Speaker of the House got a tax cut through. Trump made a lot of promises, couldn't get infrastructure, couldn't repeal the Affordable Care Act.
He kept talking about infrastructure week too.
Exactly.
Right?
So I don't think there's a lot of evidence that he's effective at working with the other side. But it's, you know, it's possible that he's learned something from the first term.
Sanford, do you think that we'll have bipartisan cooperation in Washington, D.C., or this is going to be a top-down?
I find it very doubtful. I really don't think he's, you know, for all his proclaiming that he's a deal maker, he's certainly not shown much of a proclivity to do them.
Let's go to Edward on
or much
phones.
Of an aptitude for business after all those bankruptcies either, you know.
Edward, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, gentlemen. I think I have 3 points, if I can get them all out real quick. I wanted to echo, I think it was Tony, the first caller. I just don't see the actual establishment status quo changing. Will it be tweaked, as you guys kind of hit on a few minutes ago? Of course it'll be tweaked, and it'll be rhetorically wins. But, yeah, rhetorically campaigns, Trump uses hyperbole. We all know that. We'll see how that actually plays out. Or, for instance, tweaks geopolitically. I don't for one second believe that Ukraine's funding or our support will suddenly cease to exist outright. Will it change? Sure. Maybe our allies in NATO and the EU, Ukraine's actual neighbors, step up a little bit more. That's just an example.
Okay. You said number two?
Establishment changing.
Okay.
Because they always win. Like, the oligarchy is still here, just like it was under Biden and Trump before, and Obama before that, and Bush before that, and Clinton before that. And like y'all, it's not going to change that much. He's not going to go across the line into things that actually harm business. Anyone that thinks that is a fool.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for that take there, Edward. So, I mean, I guess I'm a nut since I was kind of taking him at his word. I mean, he made these promises. He said them over and over again. And I thought, well, then that's what he's going to do. And now they're putting out some stuff today saying he's going to do mass deportations.
Well, I can think of a perfect example from the first term, right? The Muslim ban. I remember commentators kept saying, oh, he's not really going to do it. There's no way they could legally pull this off. It's just hyperbole. He's, throwing red meat to the base. And sure enough, I mean, he carried it out, family separation. I mean, a lot of these things were pretty outrageous, and he delivered on those promises.
Well, I think the thing to keep in mind is he doesn't have to run for office again, but he does have a great man theory about himself, and he doesn't want to be perceived as somebody who destroyed the country or destroyed his party. He does have people in Congress who are allies of his, but they also want to get reelected. And I think, I know there are fears out there about what could happen with Social Security, what could happen to Medicare, certainly the Affordable Care Act. And I think historically, I think we've seen the Republicans talk a lot on these issues, and they get pretty nervous when push comes to shove, because these are not making cuts, making massive changes in these kinds of things. It has not proven popular.
Well, let me ask you real quickly. Here's a question for you. Do you think, and I know the answer because of the Constitution and the limits, term limits on the president, but do you think he will try, if he survives this term, given his age and everything, you don't think he'll run for president again?
Well, as you said, he has certainly tried to push against the boundaries of the Constitution. I think it was Lauren Boebert actually put out a statement saying something about helping to get a third term for Trump. I think maybe she was misspoke.
Well, Trump says his first term doesn't count because of all the witch hunt impeachments.
Yeah.
And so he's already said that doesn't count and that he should be able to run again. So anything goes. I mean, you know, it's interesting that people have these very optimistic views about what Donald Trump is going to do and what he means. I can only take him at his word. Really quickly, before we run out of time, let's talk about what happened with the Colin Allred versus Ted Cruz, Sanford.
Yeah, I mean, that was an interesting race to watch, right? Because, you know, Allred, it was looking like a good fundraiser from North Texas. You know, he had bipartisan appeal, but he was, you know, coming from behind, and then we started seeing poll after poll saying he's catching up. It's a dead heat. He's within 1 point margin of error, all this kind of thing. And then at the end of the day, he didn't even do as well as Beto, right? Beto came within 3 points, and Colin came within 10.
Yeah.
And I was talking to some political consultants about that this morning, and the consensus seems to be people lie in polls, mm-hmm. and a lot of people don't want to admit, I'm going to go vote for Ted Cruz, but they were willing to, you know.
But you saw a reduction in the number of people who voted for Donald Trump to the people who voted for Ted Cruz, like almost 3.5 points lower. So there were people who are Republicans and would vote for Trump, but they would not vote for Cruz.
Cruz has been a uniquely unpopular figure among Republicans in the state, although he's maybe the most famous Republican. I mean, he's, you know, John Cornyn glides to victory every time. And Ted Cruz, you know, in 2018, as you pointed out, Sanford had a really close election. I mean, I think that Colin Allred was very cautious. I think he wanted to position himself as a moderate. But in the end, Ted Cruz just hammered home the issue of transgender kids in sports, made a huge, and that was basically because Colin Allred voted against a bill that Republicans put up knowing would not pass, but they wanted to use it as a campaign issue.
Yeah, it was absolutely interesting to watch that Ted Cruz had virtually no advertising talking about what he had accomplished. It was all attack ads on Colin Allred. And this one was very interesting. About a week before the election was over, the Texas Republican Party sent out this interesting one, this mailer. Colin Allred wants Texas taxpayers to pay billions to descendants of slaves, which is something that never came up during the election, something I've never even been aware that Colin Allred was for, and has reparations defined on the other side of the flyer. It was just a nice way of reminding Texans that Colin Allred is, in fact, black.
That's right. I want to also mention that, I mean, one of the underlying stories in this national election, and certainly in Texas, was how the Latino vote went. And you had 45% Latinos voting for Trump, which was, you know, remarkable for a Republican presidential candidate. And I think that you saw in Texas, the Rio Grande Valley, swinging towards Trump. You had Hidalgo County, the biggest county in the valley, going for Trump, and the valley as a whole doing that. And as somebody who grew up in the valley, a valley that's been dominated by Democratic politics, by the Democratic Party over the years, and that has shifted somewhat. But what we saw here, I think, was still really pretty stunning.
Well, Laredo Congressman Henry Cuellar, a Democrat, managed to survive, even though he is due to go on trial and. A couple in March.
Yeah.
So, and it looked there that the Furman challenger could actually dethrone him. Although Furman didn't get any national support at all, that might have been a lost opportunity for the Republicans to do another pickup.
And it was interesting, too, if you saw Furman's advertising, it didn't mention the indictment. Mm-hmm. It basically accused Cuellar of being soft on immigration, which, if you know anything about his record, he's not. It was to me, it was almost like a cookie cutter Republican ad, checking the boxes, and for whatever reason made no mention of the indictment.
One of the things too is Henry Cuellar is like actually well liked by a lot of Republicans, certainly Republicans in Congress, and so I think Republicans have never really generated that much enthusiasm. He's gotten his strongest challenges have come within the party, Democratic Party, but he hasn't gotten real sort of a very energetic opposition from Republicans.
I think the reason why they didn't attack him on his indictments is because then they would have to acknowledge that indictments are bad, which is something that doesn't work well if you're talking about defending your own candidates. And but it seemed like Henry Cuellar was able to win on the strength of his pork barrel politics, continuing seeing that he was finding funding for lots of things here in South Texas.
Yeah, that is the Ways and Means Committee is a very powerful one to be on.
And so that saved his skin for one more term. All right, we're going to take another break. We'll come back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, talking about the election that we're all trying to move on from. How do we live in this new world? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, and we're talking about the election we had yesterday. We have the results, and for many people, they were eye-opening. And what do we make of the new world, and how are we going to fit into this? The number to call in is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, and we have Sherry on the line. Sherry, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I just have to get something off my chest here. I feel profoundly disappointed in what has happened here. You know, Trump showed us that in his previous term that he doesn't understand democracy or care about democracy. And it blows my mind that we have again said, okay, let's try this again with this person who, you know, how is it possible that I kept asking myself this whole season of election season, I kept asking people, how is it possible that a convicted felon can run for president in these United States?
All right, Sherry, thank you for the call. Well, you know, voters knew exactly what they were voting on. I mean, there is no, you know, switcheroo. This is the Trump they've always known, and this is who they voted for. So, and he got a majority, well, the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. So, Gilbert Garcia, this is who's going to be president.
I think in 2016 there was a sense that there were some people who voted for Trump, thinking, I don't know what he's going to do, but he's a wild card. He might shake things up. And Hillary Clinton kind of, I don't think, ran as hard a campaign in the blue wall states as she needed to. And he was able to thread the needle there. This time, people knew with much more certainty what they were getting. I think Kamala Harris was kind of the victim of the political gravity. She was part of an administration that I think history will be kinder to Joe Biden than his contemporaries are. But 70% of the American public thought the country is headed in the wrong direction, and she was caught as a representative of that administration.
So yeah,
if you look at the polls,
really quickly though, to address the point that you've made, and I'm sorry, I cut you off. But so I had a conversation with David Frum right after Trump was elected the first time, mm-hmm. and he had that kind of great man theory in his arsenal, saying, "Well, Trump's going to shock everybody. He's not a real Republican. He's going to find a third way. He's going to fix all these problems that we have in the United States by breaking all the rules of partisan politics." And he thought he would fix the prescription drug problem and doing all these other things by thumbing his nose at both parties. Mm-hmm. And that never happened.
Well, he doesn't have the discipline. He doesn't have the knowledge of policy. If you've heard him talk about any of the major issues affecting the country and really focused on what he's saying, he has really no understanding of the details of them. And that ultimately, you know.
He understands the American people, though.
Yeah.
So that's it. So
a certain
Stanford
portion of the American people. Yeah. But look, if you look at what Kamala Harris inherited, right? I mean, inflation is a president killer. Ask Jimmy Carter, ask Gerald Ford. And when you looked at what people were talking about, it was inflation and it was the economy. And you looked at a lot of exit polls. A lot of people at the exit polls said, yeah, I know Trump is untrustworthy. I know Trump is somebody I would not necessarily hold up as a a moral person, but I was ready for change because I want something to happen different to the economy. You know, right or wrong, that was the rationale a lot of people had.
You know, and
the other thing I think that was very difficult for Kamala Harris, I think she ran a good campaign, but I think one of the fundamental problems she had was she had to walk this tightrope of not looking like she was running down Joe Biden, but also trying to make herself look different from Joe Biden and distancing herself from Joe Biden. And I think that was probably something she didn't handle too well.
Let's go to another caller, Claiborne. And Claiborne, you're on the air.
Okay. Did y'all take a moment to discuss the nexus of today's discussion with Monday's show?
And Monday's show being the rise of Hitler?
And what a joke he was perceived to be before he took over.
Yeah, but and you know what got me about that conversation that we had with Tim Ryback about his book, The Rise of Hitler, was he said that the Weimar Republic died twice, first by suicide, and then it was killed by the Nazi Party. That's kind of what's going in through my mind. But what are you thinking of, Claiborne? What are your thoughts?
It's happened twice. I mean, we're living 1933 all over again, and lots of it are the same dynamics.
Yeah.
It's depressing.
All right. Well, thank you for your call. I appreciate that. You know, it's not helpful to talk about Trump in the terms of Hitler and the fall of the German Republic and the rise of Nazi Germany. You know, that's just because this is where we are. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's no longer theoretical. We live in this world, and he's not going to set up camps and you know set up an industrial murdering machine. I don't know about where we are with the health of our democracy. You know, mm-hmm. Gilbert.
Yeah, he's somebody who has, I think, very little regard for democracy, and I think that he tends to admire political strongmen. One thing that when we're talking about 1930s Germany versus the United States now. I think part of the America First sort of ideology that Trump has tends to be let's not get involved in foreign wars, or let's not employ the military because what's the benefit for us? What's the economic benefit? What's the angle for us? His opposition to NATO is basically like, why should we even bother defending them? What do we care about
Denmark?
So he is not. I don't think he has that sort of the Hitler the world conquering sort of mentality. I think he's very much about we're in it for us and nobody else.
So I want to bring up something that did happen yesterday in the election. Amarillo voters overwhelmingly rejected the city's proposition A, which aimed to essentially ban all abortion-related travel in the city, what they call, activists call, abortion trafficking. The proposed sanctuary city for the unborn ordinance was voted down 59% to 41%. And this is Amarillo that we're talking about here. This election that we had across the country was very much about abortion rights. And Sanford, you know, what do you make about this Amarillo vote, which was a kind of a shocker.
Yeah, I think maybe so. But if you look at the statistics, even in Texas, right, the majority of people, when you poll them, think abortion should be legal, right? I mean, the number of people, you know, it escalates when you start talking about women's health being involved, that sort of thing. So I do think, yeah, even in conservative Amarillo, there you can go too far with this stuff.
If I could say, I think one of the challenges Kamala Harris, I think that she was strongest on the issue of abortion. She spoke in great detail and with a lot of passion about reproductive rights. I think one of the challenges she had was we've already lost the federal right to legalized abortion. I think most people who look at this closely knew that even if she got elected, it was going to be very difficult to ever get legislation passed at the federal level that would restore the protections of Roe v. Wade. So they might have agreed with her critique of what the Supreme Court did and what Trump has done.
People don't think about it that hard.
I think some people do.
All right, let's go to another caller because we're running out of time. Randall. And Randall, you're on the air. Go ahead.
All right. I'm going to be real quick here. Polls, of course, they're crazy. I'm a Kansas area code phone number person. I still have my Kansas area code, and I have participated in three polls this year thinking that I was a Kansas voter, but I've been living and voting in Texas for 3 years. Okay, second of all, I think a lot of people voted on this economic fantasy that a president, any president, has the ability to step into the Oval Office, wave their hand or push a button, and a grocery store prices immediately roll back 5 years. If a president can roll them back 5 years, why not a decade, 20 years, 50 years? I think there are going to be some very, very rude awakenings for everyone.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Randall. So do you think that that was the thing that propelled Donald Trump into the White House, the carton of eggs price, Stanford?
Yeah, I do think, you know, that was why we didn't see many of those core constituencies perform for Kamala Harris the way they did in 2020 for Joe Biden. I mean, it was a lot of little cuts and they added up. And I think the economy and inflation was a driving factor for a lot of those people.
Well, let me ask you
and
this,
I think,
though,
as the caller pointed out, they're going to find that,
do you think America just is not ready for a woman, a black woman, to be president?
I do think that hurt her numbers. Yes, I do. I do think there is a certain contingency of voters who are not willing to see a woman in the White House, and I do think there's a contingency of voters who are, racist. You know,
and so Gilbert,
I'm not sure.
Do you
I
think
put
that
the
was a difference
what...
maker between her and Joe Biden 4 years earlier?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, again, she also was running on a record, which I think a record that had substantial legislative achievement, but people were frustrated with inflation. So I think that she was running under a different set of circumstances. But I think, yes, absolutely, the fact that she's a woman, the fact she was a black woman, there's no doubt in my mind that that was a factor. I mean, I can't say how big a factor, and would voters be honest about how much it played into
all them? You need to do is look at that mailer I just talked about that they sent out about Colin Allred to know that there are voters for whom color of the candidate's skin is a significant
and
deciding
gender,
factor.
And moving forward, the Democratic Party, it's not going to be, this can't become Republican light, Gilbert Garcia. They need a new platform. They need a whole new identity.
Yeah. Well, so much about personalities. And that's what we found. I mean, Obama, you know, attracted a lot of independents and Republicans, not necessarily by moving hard to the right, but it was a personality thing.
I do think one of the messages that the Democrats need to zoom in on, they really need to make sure they start paying attention to it, is that we care about you. We care about you if you're working class and if you're middle class. And that the numbers we saw voting in this election did not reflect
that
working class
was
folks were lining
and it
up
fell flat.
Behind Kamala Harris.
This is the world.
Yeah.
Sanford Nowlin, thank you so much. Editor-in-Chief of the San Antonio Current, and Gilbert Garcia, former Express News Metro columnist. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.